EC.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Thursdays at this time, it's the Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Gudnick. And Dave, you're starting off with a little back and forth in Congress.
Well, not immediately. Thanks, Don. We'll get to that. It's not exactly the most informative, but it's somewhat entertaining and shows the kind of lies and lack of clarity for getting out of Washington. But last week I thought we'd be talking more about Ukraine, which hasn't been such a main topic here, but and we will be focusing on war, but the situation is really dire in the Persian Gulf, and we'll have a lot on the U.S.-Israel war on Iran, and also on the U.S.-European war on Russia in Ukraine, because both are escalating, and they've got deeper ties, too. Later you'll hear an excellent historical summary background on both war theaters and the plan for U.S. dominance. That's be from Professor Jeffrey Sachs, and then at the end, an insightful geopolitical summary from former British diplomat Alistair Crook. But we've got a lot of material between now and that. In this 1 hour, about half of it or a little more will be tapes from about three or four different sources. And I've got other good comments that I've copied in a lot of reading and listening. I actually had something from Professor Omer Bartov, who you just heard from there, the Brown University professor of genocide studies. And his article earlier this week, which I did read originally, was titled "Israel Normalizes Genocide," and you heard some of his comments on that. My own comment, not original to me, is that Israel's slogan is "Never again unless we do it." But I wanted to quote Professor Bartov's final paragraph. I think it's just really a good, clear summary of all of the issues involved in the horrible situation there in Palestine. Quote, "For now, Israel's impunity will enable its Jewish citizens to continue to ignore the genocide, the consequences of which will be a deepening degradation of Israeli ethics and morality, erosion of the rule of law, internal police violence against the state's Palestinian and Jewish citizens, and the undermining of whatever is left of Israeli democracy. Beyond being deprived of any justice and accountability for their suffering, the Gaza victims of Israeli actions will continue to live in dire conditions under military supervision and with very limited future prospects." Unquote. I want to add, with regard to what's happening right now in the U.S. Congress, where already the House has passed the National Defense Authorization Act with appalling, outrageous provisions that it's going to integrate Israeli intelligence and military planning with ours. Having trashed the U.S., having trashed the JCPOA, that is the agreement originally under Obama to limit nuclear arms and allow international inspections in Iran. Trump, of course, threw that out. Now we're spreading the threat of nuclear arms in Iran and now in Saudi Arabia. And, of course, those weapons are already in Israel. Former Zionist spies such as Jonathan Pollard, now out of prison and comfortably in Israel, will no longer be needed if the new NDAA passes the Senate and institutionalizes Israel power in the U.S. military and intelligence structures. So there's a monumental thing going on there that has not happened before in U.S. history or with any other nation being so infiltrated into our leading structures. I encountered for the first time in a long time Liberation News Network, and they had a great piece on Iran war. I'd like to read a couple paragraphs or so from there. Actually, it's a little more, but I really think it's excellent, from earlier this week. The Trump administration, like its predecessor, is offering elements within Iran's leadership a choice. They can have integration into the U.S.-led system, access to Western financial markets, relief from sanctions, the promise of economic normalization, the rewards that flow to compliant comprador bourgeoisie across the global South. Or they can be subjected to continued aggression, bombing campaigns, economic sanctions, assassinations of scientists and military commanders, cyber warfare, and covert action designed to fracture the state from within. This is not a new strategy. It is the oldest strategy in the imperialist playbook, refined through Korea, Vietnam, Chile, and Iraq. The bombing is a lethal component of U.S. negotiation. The violence is not separate from diplomacy. It is the diplomacy. The message is simple. The cost of resistance will exceed the cost of capitulation, eventually, inevitably, if we simply maintain the pressure long enough. And by creating this atmosphere of permanent instability and economic stagnation, we, the U.S., hope to break the relative unity of the Iranian masses. We hope to secure defections from the government side. We hope to cultivate a faction within Iran that will see compromise with the U.S. as the only way out, as the only way forward. This is the guiding strategy. It will not be found in Trump's statements. It will not be admitted in Pentagon press conferences, but it is the logic that underpins every bomb dropped, every sanction imposed, every cyber attack launched. And it goes on to point out the model is Chile, 1970 to 73, and the same book had been applied to Cuba for six decades, punishing sanctions and a variety of other tactics there. I've got another quote or so, and then we'll get into Jeffrey, the congressional testimony, which is lively, but not as substantial. Some of the things I want to quote here. This is now from Eve Smith. I've recommended her at nakedcapitalism.com. Her summary, Trump has committed himself to the punishment of Iran to get them to let go of the Strait of Hormuz, as in capitulate. But as many have said, not only does the U.S. lack the ability to do so, but it is about to be exposed as the emperor that has no clothes, and in woefully short of means, much sooner than most press outlets have conditioned the public to expect. Iran is forcing evacuation of U.S. bases in the Gulf and may also force retreat from Jordan to Israel. This increases the odds of a desperate Trump engaging in an ultimately ineffective show of strength, possibly in the form of a shock and awe bombing campaign on Pickaxe Mountain, where the U.S. believes Iran's enriched uranium and centrifuges are housed. Final quote from Eve Smith. Senior U.S. intelligence officials have concluded that Iran's ballistic missile program has continued to advance despite close to 5 months of intensive American and Israeli attacks, raising growing concerns in Washington regarding the long-term effectiveness of the military campaign. The response from Iran officials came very quickly. First from Chief Negotiator M.B. Ghalibaf, as translated by Twitter, quote, the equation of this war is clear, either all or none. In a region where we do not sell oil, no one will sell oil. If our security is not ensured, no infrastructure will be safe, and the security of the Strait is in the absence of American forces. We have repeatedly said that the situation of the Strait will not return to pre-war conditions. Don, you want to add anything? I can keep going.
You know, that is pretty hard to get your mind around, that things have changed.
It's really looking dire. Escalation. Also, as I mentioned in Ukraine, but a significant escalation just the past few days, and there's no clear way out. I want to, just on a slightly different angle, give you about 2-3 minutes of Senator Gillibrand trying to have an exchange and question Secretary of Defense, our little slick, fast-talking bullshitter, and it's you can see how productive an exchange it is. This was just earlier in Congress, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and Secretary of War Hegseth.
For unlimited money for bombs when people can't feed their families. And I don't know how this administration intends to defend those decisions to the American people.
Not unlimited bombs, Senator. I'm asking for the right bombs at the right time to ensure we can deter our adversaries into the future. And that's why this is a generational investment. And
it was
the previous administration that didn't fund this department.
The reason why they are so upset with you and this administration is because the words you have used in the past don't add up. About Iran specifically, you said that we had obliterated, quote unquote, Iran's ability to create nuclear weapons. The president made the same claim. Yet 8 months later, in February of 2026, the president launched an act of war claiming Iran was within 2 weeks of having a weapon. So when you say two very different things, the American people don't know who to believe or what to believe. They just know they can't afford their health care, they can't afford their food, they can't afford housing, and our farmers are continuing to suffer. So, which is true? Was it obliterated or wasn't it? What's the status?
The nuclear sites under Midnight Hammer were obliterated, but Iranians foolishly continued to attempt to pursue nuclear capabilities, which is why we destroyed their defense industrial base and so many of the other capabilities to ensure they can't get to a nuclear weapon. See, we're staying laser focused on the objective, and you're trying to make campaign commercials.
No, we're not.
And that's fine.
So listen to this. You also say that you made the missile program, quote, destroyed and made combat ineffective, quote, Iran's entire ballistic missile production capacity, every company that builds every component of those missiles has been functionally defeated and destroyed, and that the missile program, existing stockpiles were depleted and decimated, almost completely ineffective. So why are there missiles left to hit Jordan and result in the loss of life of our brave men and women?
As we stated from the beginning, the Iranian defense industrial base is effectively gone. But they do have underground facilities because they're the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and they've spent 47 years trying to hide their missiles under mountains,
just like their
nuclear capabilities, because they would like to get
just
a nuclear weapon to wield it against us.
Don't know what version of the war to believe, because it's either over or it's not over. It's within 2 weeks or it's not 2 weeks. We have no missiles or we have missiles, and that consternation is why so many New Yorkers are perplexed, stressed out, and find this war to be incredibly unpopular because they don't understand the choices that the president's making.
Exactly.
That again, trying to question Secretary Hegseth, you know, he introduced a total canard and non sequitur to answer in failing to answer questions where he talks about Iran as the leading leading state sponsor of terrorism. Well, That's an utter lie. Anybody who's honestly looking at what's going on in the world regards the United States as a leading source of terrorism. And, a common definition is violence attacks against civilians for political purpose. Well, we do this all the time. So there's one gigantic lie there. In addition, Iran is not the source of, by any means, most of the Islamic terrorism going on in the Middle East. The State Department's own study, cited by some people that we've had on this program, showed that 95% of the terrorist acts were by Sunni. Okay, the Iranians are Shiite and are not sponsoring most of the Islamic terrorist events that have been plaguing the region for years. So I just want to say that about state-sponsored terrorism, which he slips in there so fast you can hardly think about it, but it's a big lie. Here's one more good quote that I picked up somewhere. Trump is clueless about missile shortages as he escalates Iran war. Quote, as Trump's attacks on Iran resume and his rhetoric escalates, reports are emerging that officials in the Pentagon are just not telling the White House and Pete Hegseth the truth about how depleted the U.S. arsenal actually has become. Why? Largely because Hegseth's purges of senior figures have trained everyone to understand that the bearers of bad news, or even just cold reality as it exists outside of Donald Trump's wishful thinking, generally get fired. So it could well be that this escalation is the biggest mistake of the war so far. End of that quote. Here's some more comments of my own before leading into Jeffrey Sachs. Why are we at war with Iran? Ask six sources and you may get six answers. Promote internal rebellion and regime change in Iran? Failed. And why is that a goal? Prevent Iran from obtaining capacity to produce nuclear weapons? Failed. And why is that not a goal regarding Israel? Secretary Hegseth's rants in Congress about needing $1.5 trillion in weapon spending and the threat of, quote, Islamic fanatics having a nuclear weapon. But what about Zionist fanatics with nuclear weapons? More recently, the chief U.S. clown stated that the goal of the war is to open the Strait of Hormuz, which, of course, was open before the war launched by U.S. and Israel, first in June 2025 and then in late February 2026 for 4 days and now resuming. Now we are planning another even larger disaster. Again, why is the U.S. at war against Iran? And recall that it's been going on for decades, not just under Trump. To protect Israel, to advance the military and industrial complex to a $1.5 trillion annual allocation, to protect U.S. dollar dominance, these are all factors. The same question can be asked about why the U.S. and NATO are at war with Russia in Ukraine. And we again have been treated to years of lying, duplicitous official explanations. Let's look a bit more deeply with help from Jeffrey Sachs. He's had a good article in consortiumnews.com site, as well as interviews covering similar ground, one on the Glenn Deason program at greater length, and the one I'm going to quote in a little bit shorter on the Judge Napolitano show. The whole point is he's trying to help people understand where these wars come from, and they date back, importantly, to the 1990s, as highlighted by Zbigniew Brzezinski and his famous book, The Grand Chessboard, published 1997, which outlined the whole strategy, which has been followed in much detail since then. But to my mind, I just want to add that Sachs, while he's an economist, acknowledges but understates the importance of the dominance of the U.S. dollar. This was admitted, if that's the right word, by Secretary Treasurer Bessent just recently. We have to protect the dollar. That's why we're at war. He said it. But the dominance of the U.S. dollar plays out in multiple fashions through its trade, exorbitant privilege, its debt-based inflation, its decades of cruel and illegal but powerful sanctions. Remember, I said on the show previously that, according to the Lancet study, over 500,000 per year are killed by our cruel sanctions, denial of food, medicine, and fuel, mostly women and children. That's terrorism, my friends. Other weapons, the exclusion from the SWIFT international banking system and through bribes and IMF and World Bank policies, both of these have been applied in both instances to Russia and to Iran. And importantly, of course, it's not completely succeeding by any means. Sachs goes on in an interview, but I want to say a little bit more from his excellent written background. That's again on the Consortium News site of this week. The aim, this is the central statement of this whole point from Sachs, the aim is American primacy, meaning the unchallenged wealth, power, and prerogatives of American elites, unchecked by any other nation or group of nations. What this means in practice is that Wall Street, military contractors, Silicon Valley, and big oil control American foreign policy to maximize elite wealth and access to global resources, supply chains, and strategic choke points. The rest of the world is to fall in line. The military-industrial complex deploys a toolkit that we summarize as, quote, regime control, directed at subordinating the rest of the world's governments to the U.S. The instruments, he gives a list here, and it's quite comprehensive in a way, and I don't expect you to absorb it all, but here's some of the things we use, the instruments we use for regime control: the imposition or removal of trade barriers, the access to or denial of technology, the introduction or removal of economic sanctions, the ownership and manipulation of foreign media, electoral interference of varying extent, political assassinations, color revolutions, and CIA-backed coups, the instigation of overseas bank runs and the supply of emergency loans when states submit, the freezing and unfreezing of frozen of foreign assets, the targeting of foreign officials with corruption claims, extradition, or kidnapping, and when none of these suffice for regime control, outright war. One more sentence, and then we'll hear from Jeffrey Sachs. The U.S. wars of choice, really wars for regime control, are perpetual and lucrative for the war industries, although the deep state typically prefers that other governments cave in without a fight. Sachs gives a great and sorry catalog of our imperial expansion under all the recent U.S. presidents. So I'm going to hear from him for about 7 minutes, and then we'll take a break.
About American primacy. So the idea is that the United States has to be the biggest and baddest and toughest and can beat anybody in the world, anywhere. And that's the idea, that there should be no resistance to American demands anywhere, and that the United States should basically be intervening everywhere in order to prevent any other countries from getting powerful enough or aligning so that they can resist American demands. America as number one bully of the world. And Brzezinski lays out how this should be done. Remember, in the 1990s, the Soviet Union had just collapsed, and the idea was everywhere. In Clinton's mouth and in Madeleine Albright's Secretary of State's words, that the U.S. is the indispensable nation that looks farther than any other nation in the world. And we had the project for the new American century, which is basically we'll beat the shit out of anyone that opposes the United States. So we had it called the end of history. We had it called the unipolar moment. And what Brzezinski explains is how we're going to play this chessboard, this worldwide chessboard. And the most fascinating aspect of Brzezinski's analysis is he's like a chess teacher explaining how to move the pieces. And he has a concept which is very important for everybody to understand how crazy our government is. And the concept is a geopolitical pivot state. What is a geopolitical pivot state? Brzezinski tells us. It's a place we don't care about, except that it can annoy the hell out of another major power. In other words, it's a place we can use. And Brzezinski's core idea in this book is the United States needs to achieve its primacy and maintain its primacy, being the biggest and the baddest, in Eurasia, the great landmass of Europe and Asia that it joins together into really one supercontinent, where about 70% of the world's population lives and about 70% of the world economy. And of course, it includes China, it includes Russia, it includes India, it includes Europe. And the United States needs to dominate all of this. And Brzezinski nicely tells us that Europe, well, they're vassal states. We're the empire, they're vassals, they'll do what we say. Pretty much true. And then there are the pivot states, the geopolitical pivots. Number one geopolitical pivot, he tells us in 1997, is Ukraine. If we control Ukraine, Russia ceases to be a major power because Russia's blocked from its entry into the Eastern Mediterranean. Russia can't project its power. And so Ukraine is a geopolitical pivot state. And in 1997, in this book and in another article that Brzezinski writes called A Grand Strategy for Eurasia for Foreign Affairs. And Brzezinski's not just some run-of-the-mill guy. He's one of the major strategists of our country, telling us how it works and how Washington thinks. He says we need to control Ukraine So we need to push NATO to Ukraine and push American power to the Russian border. Incidentally, Mark Rutte, who is the Secretary General of NATO, and a really despicable character, by the way, and maybe that just goes with the turf of being Secretary General of NATO, said a few days ago that NATO's purpose is, it's not defense against the Soviet Union, it's the projection of American power. Basically, or I should say exactly, what Brzezinski was telling us in 1997. And what Brzezinski says is, we need to take Ukraine, we need to take the other geopolitical pivots. Ah, what's number two on his list? Iran. Oh, fancy that. What a coincidence. We need to bother China in East Asia by bulking up the military in Korea, where we have been for 80 years, for God's sake. 80 years stationed there since the Korean War. And bulking up the military in Japan and bothering China in every other possible way, because these are the geopolitical pivots. We need to use these places to annoy, to weaken, to divide, to subvert, maybe even to overthrow the governments of our big adversaries. And Brzezinski writes it all out in a long tome. And basically everything he says is wrong, except that it explains everything that we have done and continue to do until now. Because until today, whether it's Clinton or Bush or Obama or Trump 1 or Biden or Trump 2, doesn't matter. The name of the game in Washington is, we're number one. The military-industrial complex will be fed fully, gluttonously, to the maximum extent to keep that dominant power, that primacy, and we'll fight anyone, we'll subvert any government, we'll use any geopolitical pivot to do that. And we get all these countries into horrific trouble. We prove the famous adage of Henry Kissinger, his famous quip, which is a tragic truth, that to be an enemy of the United States is dangerous, but to be a friend is fatal. And so
there again, Jeffrey Sachs, we'll be coming back to him. I wanted to get that famous Kissinger quote in there because it's true. Can be fatal to be a friend of the United States. I wanted to flesh out a little bit, again, based on Sachs' own writing, some of what he just said about all the presidents. So I'm just going to run quickly through how, again, we got to our present situation and what each of these presidents has some responsibility for. Bill Clinton set out to enlarge NATO to Ukraine and other border states of Russia, counting on Russia being too weak to object. Clinton launched NATO enlargement in the 1990s over George Kennan's, our foremost diplomat, George Kennan's warning that it was, quote, the most fateful error of American policy in the entire post-Cold War era, unquote. And despite the legally binding assurances given by the U.S. to Mikhail Gorbachev in 1990 that NATO would move not one inch eastward. George Bush then withdrew from the ABM Treaty and at Bucharest in 2008 committed NATO to membership for Ukraine and Georgia, crossing what William Burns, then ambassador in Moscow and now or later CIA director, privately called, quote, the brightest of all red lines, unquote, for the entire Russian elite. Of course, we ignored that. Then Barack Obama's administration backed the 2014 Maidan overthrow of Ukraine's elected neutral government. We know this through Victoria Nuland's intercepted call where she discusses choosing the next prime minister. And then we supported the new regime's bid to join NATO. It's followed by Donald Trump in his first term sent Javelin system to the U.S.-backed regime, escalating the war with Kiev to fight the breakaway Russian-speaking Donbass regions in eastern Ukraine. Then Joe Biden brushed aside Russia's December 2021 draft security treaties without negotiating and scuttled the near agreement between Russia and Ukraine at Istanbul in the spring of 2022, which would have ended the war. And so the war continues to this day. And all this stuff also puts to lie to the endlessly repeated statement that this Russian invasion was unprovoked. And Don and I have spent a few years trying to explain how this is quite the contrary is the case, and trying to introduce some comments about this whole string of presidents there, thankfully summarized by Professor Jack Sachs, to show that it's not a matter of Trump.
Yes, the unprovoked. There's a book, big fat book, 600 pages, about all the provoked actions by the United States over the Ukraine against Russia.
Here's a few more minutes from Professor Jeffrey Sachs returning to Israel, which, of course, is at the heart of all of this.
Said was initiated because we have to protect Israel. Will this bring about the demise of the Netanyahu government?
If the Netanyahu government falls, nothing better is going to replace it. I think Netanyahu, one way or another, is probably reaching his end. He's one of the great disasters of politics of the last 30 years. He's done what Trump actually said about him a few weeks ago, which is everybody hates you, Trump told Netanyahu, and everybody hates Israel. That's pretty accurate. Israel behaves despicably. It's the worst of the worst around the world. Netanyahu is a thug leading a thuggish regime that has multiple arrest warrants by the International Criminal Court, which, of course, the United States then sanctions the court rather than respecting the fact that Israel is led by genocidaires, the people who commit genocide, with our complete complicity. Will Netanyahu finally fall? Yeah, probably. Will the replacement be any better? It doesn't look like it. I don't hear anything in Israeli politics that says, hey, we shouldn't commit genocide. Hey, there are 8 million Palestinian people. We should live together in peace with them. Hey, maybe it isn't the right idea to go assassinate the leader of Iran. No, I don't hear a word like that anywhere. Nor do I hear anything much in Washington either about, I mean, we have opposition in Washington to some of this, so I don't want to denigrate people who are speaking out. But basically, the war machine continues in the United States because, as has been true for decades, our politics are controlled by the military-industrial complex. The presidents come and go, but the underlying idea that we need to feed the war machine so that America can kick the ass of any country in the world and thereby enrich, and I should have emphasized this, the ultimate goal is the enrichment of Wall Street, the enrichment of big oil, the enrichment of Silicon Valley, the enrichment of our billionaire class. It's pretty straightforward and pretty basic. But the point is, it's so deep-seated that, you know, we had Jeanette Sheehan, the Democratic Party senator from New Hampshire. I saw a clip. I hope I'm not misquoting her. Yeah. But she was complaining that Zelensky fired a particular defense minister, Fedorov, first of all, what is an American senator doing intervening in the choice of the defense minister? Well, it's obvious. Sheehan sits on the Armed Services Committee. She's deeply funded by the military industrial complex. That's American corruption up the wazoo. And that's how this whole system works. It's just too big a business. And Wall Street depends on these prerogatives. Big oil depends on these prerogatives. The military industry itself depends on these prerogatives. Silicon Valley and its financial bubble that it is living on depends on the image of America being able to take on anybody and defeat anybody. And it's a complete hubristic delusion that we're living in right now. And it just gets more and more murderous and more dangerous because it's so mistaken and wrongheaded. And maybe I'll stop the rant by just saying none of these wars has any deep reason. None of them involves American security in the least. None of them is impervious to solution through straightforward diplomacy. We don't want peace, or Washington doesn't want peace. It wants dominance. That it can't have, but it could have peace, and the American people could have security, and we could actually save some trillions of dollars that we have squandered and continue to waste if we had just a modicum of understanding and transparency and accountability of our rogue government.
That again is Jeffrey Sachs. I think that's pretty powerful summary of how we're descending into international lawlessness and war and without diplomacy. I like to quote diplomats and academics and others who particularly have a lot of international experience, because I think that's an area that not only is among the most urgent and important, but also among the most neglected by our mainstream media. One brief note, I made a mistake last week in introducing former Ambassador Chaz Freeman. He was in the diplomatic corps for over 30 years, serving primarily in the Mideast. He was also Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he was Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, but also has spoken about a lot of experience in and with Israel, but he was not Ambassador to Israel, which I think I misstated last week. So that was Ambassador Chaz Freeman. I'm sure we'll have him back. Don, anything?
No, but it's... Jeffrey Sachs is one of the most guiding lights for understanding all of this, what's been going on in the foreign policy. And he doesn't seem to get any traction other than what we lift up off of some YouTube sites.
Yeah, they're not welcome in the mainstream anymore when you have that kind of powerful anti-imperial historical perspective. Here's a similar perspective, only much briefer, from Ian Proud, a Great Britain, former British diplomat, and he's on the Glenn Deason program, and this is just a couple minutes, but I think it's really pretty good. Again, this is former British diplomat Ian Proud.
Somebody that the West liked even less, you know, would come to power. So the question is really, you know, why do we insist on pushing this? Okay, you know, the CIA, MI6 have a history of regime change going back to since the end of the Second World War, and it didn't really work in small, underdeveloped, kind of Latin American states, Central European states, and that sort of thing. In terms of a durable political settlement, how do they possibly expect it to work in Russia? A very complex, very large, economically prosperous, military powerful kind of nation, you know, like Russia. You know, it's clearly a ridiculous kind of concept and people should give up on it. But what people really should be thinking about is how can we see through our underlying distrust, which has obviously grown over the past 12 years, and find a way to coexist, not necessarily to be friends, but to coexist peacefully in the way that actually our interests and Russia's interests and Ukraine's interests, for that matter, aren't harmed. Nobody is really doing that thinking in the West. To go back to the foreign policy, you know, we're locked into this belief, a deluded belief in my view, that we can somehow defeat Russia. And if we just wait a bit longer, if we just give Zelensky a few more billion dollars of money, if we just, you know, send more Ukrainian men back from Europe to fight, if we just don't let all these constant, you know, scandals around Zelensky distract us from the real enemy, then eventually things will be okay. Well, I just don't think they will be okay. You know, Ukraine can't win this war. Ukraine is being turned into a failed state, a depopulated failed state, because of a war that we've encouraged them to keep fighting. And it really is disgraceful that we've done that.
That again, former British diplomat Ian Proud, a nice succinct statement there. Now I have a final tape from another ex-diplomat at much greater length, but I think it's really quite insightful. It's Alistair Crook, another former British diplomat. He's being interviewed on the Chris Hedges program, and talks about, again, foreign policy misreadings and what's the basis of some of these current wars. Let's see here. Here's Alistair Crook.
And can't be included. The Iranian position is very simple. It's going to be either a ceasefire for all or a ceasefire for nobody. If the Israelis insist that Lebanon is outside of these agreements and outside of these discussions, then in that case, Israel can be outside of these discussions and Iran will continue the war on Israel. So I think it's unclear how far we are going to get, but the expectations, as I hear or judge from there, are not very optimistic that something will emerge. And it's not surprising. I mean, I don't think it's surprising. I'm sure it isn't surprising to you, because there are enormous contradictions in this whole process. They are the differences in the interests of the United States and of Iran, and what Iran's objectives are, which are very poorly understood, I believe, in the United States and poorly understood more generally in the West, how serious they are, the objectives for this war. I mean, in a nutshell, the objectives of Iran are to blow up the existing paradigm. That is a revolutionary objective, to blow it up completely in order that they can escape, if you like, from the cage in which they've been held. Select targets. Then they have surface drones, high speed, very high speed drones with explosives in much stronger position. There is a lot of propaganda on all sides in this war, but there are some things that one can say very clearly, that Iran has effected enormous damage on American bases in the Gulf area. It has destroyed all the radar abilities. I think altogether something like 7 radars have been destroyed in the first phase of the war. They have not only destroyed that, they have complete control over the Hormuz, and they have still, at this time, you know, of course, Iran doesn't have an air force and therefore cannot have air dominance, but instead of which they have created missile dominance over the airspace of the whole region, and including Israel. The damage to their missile capabilities has been grossly overstated by the old tactic of just counting, this goes back to Vietnam, counting airstrikes. And one of the things that has been most notable in this period is before the war, Iran bought from China a huge number of decoys, decoy planes, decoy missiles. And one of the things, not only are they very effective in their appearance, but I didn't know until recently, is they have a heat source in them. So they are hot. And so, of course, that shows up on the American sensors and the Israeli sensors as a real target, a real plane, a real missile, when it's really only a decoy. The missile systems are buried deep in mountains. The main one, a main missile, is 800 meters under a granite mountain. It has a whole railway system in the mountain, and that carries the missiles from the cities, from the magazine, along a railway track to an entrance. A door opens, the missile is fired from the railway line, and then the door shuts. And although it's been bombed innumerable times, part of that, you know, 16,000 strikes we have made on Iran, it still functions. Half an hour after the airstrike, the missile comes out and continues. The mountain is getting slightly damaged and black, but nothing is affecting the missile cities. Their command system is functioning thanks to the mosaic decentralization of command, disbursement of command. It's created almost a sort of mechanical structure that snaps into action as soon as Iran is attacked or as soon as there is an attempt at decapitation strike. I mean, they started instituting this after what they saw in 2003 with the attack, American attack on Baghdad, that they had to find a way of countering this and countering the air attacks that took place in Baghdad. So, I mean, it's impossible to give precise figures, but I believe that the amount of deaths in Tehran are probably less than in the 12-day war. They did this simply by a very simple, they learned from the 12-day war, empty every public building completely. So universities, everything are completely empty. All the government offices empty. And so Israel has been destroying those, counting those up as a huge damage caused to Iran. And the most significant thing I would say is the financial aspect of it. In the first month of this war, Iran has earned double from the sale of its oil, from its oil sales and tankers, double what it has earned in any month for several years past. It's earned double. If you take just one case, about a week ago last Sunday, there were five tankers loading at Karg with 7.7 million barrels of oil. That on one day earned Iran $850 million from just the sales. Then, of course, they are earning from 2 million from every tanker and vessel that passes through Hormuz as part of the toll that they are insisting that ships have to pay. So the economic situation is, they calculate, one can calculate from these figures, not just me, but others have done that, you know, on this basis, the Iran could earn a little short of $1 trillion a year through the control of the Hormuz. But it doesn't stop there, and I will explain why, because it's also about supply lines. It controls supply lines, helium, sulfuric acid, all of these essential elements to our supply lines for manufacturing technical items, and also for manufacturing chips and things. The chip factory in Taiwan is almost at a standstill now because they need helium and they need liquefied gas in order to make chips. So supply lines, food, fertilizer, this is it. It's like, if you like, compare it to what happened with China when Trump imposed a huge tariff on China, 155, I think, percent at one point it was. And President Xi said, well, okay, but I'm putting some restrictions actually on rare earths and other commodities. And so that's going to be what you're going to have to do without. And of course, it changed. And so really that the Chinese tactic is also part of the Hormuz structure. It's not just the sale of oil, not just the tolls, but it is about supply lines, and it is also something much more complicated, which is the insistence that the cargoes be paid in yuan. Mm. And this is a part of, if you like, deculturizing, the attempt to deculture the whole of the GCC area, which is part, it has always been the central hub of, if you like, dollar hegemony. This is the center of the petrodollar, and it was encouraged from 73 when it started, you know, to keep the oil price up because all of the proceeds go to Wall Street. Wall Street then leverage it in the financial world, and so you have in the Gulf states a highly financialized type of economy with all of the data centers and others there. And Iran is telling the Gulf states, if you want to enjoy a relationship with Iran, you have to get rid of Microsoft, Amazon. You have to get rid of these. What do you need this huge 30 billion data center in the UAE? You have to get rid of this. This is, if you like, part of I wouldn't call it a cultural revolution because it's a financial cultural revolution that the Iranians are seeking to establish. That's what I mean by breaking the paradigm. I'm sorry it's a complicated explanation, but it's bigger than just, you know, can ships go up or down Hormuz? It is a much bigger, more ambitious plan than is properly appreciated.
That again is Alistair Crook. I'd like to play five more minutes of him. He's being interviewed on the Chris Hedges show. And it's a good explication of why we keep returning to the topic of the strength of the dollar and these wars in pursuit of defending and extending the power of the dollar internationally. Anything you want to add, Don?
No, but he really laid it out there. Much greater ramifications than, you know, I knew some of it, but he really added to it.
Yeah, it really gives a sense of the depth of it, of this confrontation, and why it's unlikely to end soon, unfortunately. Here's about five more minutes from Alistair Crook.
I know this is a difficult question, but how do you read the Trump administration? Do you think that they are aware of how cornered they are?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think this has been a complete misreading, first of all, of the nature of Iran. I think they thought that that Iran was a house of cards and was going to collapse. We saw that very clearly from the New York Times account of the 11th of February meeting, which incidentally is only half the story because we were following in the Hebrew press on the 29th of December, when Netanyahu came and had the summit at Mar-a-Lago with Trump. It was there that he laid down very clearly to Trump first, and he said, you know, forget the nuclear issue. You're not to pursue that. You have to concentrate on the one issue. We have to end the missiles. End them, because the Iranians are not just replacing them, they're creating entirely new umbrella, a new paradigm. And if it isn't done, they will be, you know, inviolable. We won't be able to attack them again in the future. So you have to put that as your first priority and not the nuclear issue. And if you try to get out of this by doing the nuclear issue, Netanyahu told him, quote from many sources in the Hebrew press, we won't give you a kosher certificate for that. We're not going to accept another sort of JCPOA type solution. And if you don't have that, you won't have the support of the right in the United States. So you have to do this, and there has to be this attack on Iran. And according to all of the newspapers, that was agreed in principle on the 29th of January, well before the 11th of February meeting that the New York Times has described. And again, during that, it is clear Trump was convinced this was going to be a very short war, days at most, you know, one weekend. Started on you know, Saturday, and by the time markets open on Monday, you know, the Supreme Leader would be dead and the whole thing would be moving towards a regime change in Iran. And it very clearly hasn't happened that. In fact, something quite different is happening. It's very hard to describe this correctly. And I'm not trying to, you know, this isn't wishful thinking, my part, but it's quite clear to me that there is a spirit of the Iranian revolution in its new form has come back, particularly amongst the young. You can see it when Trump threatened you know, to end the civilization, the Iranian civilization. Everyone streamed out onto the bridges, onto the nuclear power station, and said, okay, here we are. You know, if you're going to kill us, you kill us. I mean, this reflects a deep Shi'i readiness to accept sacrifice, personal sacrifice, in the interests of your community, in the interests of Iran, as a civilization, a symbol of civilization. So there is a powerful thing, particularly amongst the young people now. They are much more, if you like, fired up after the killing of the Supreme Leader, and much more fired up. And young women, boys, men, it is something that is quite important, and in my belief is having an effect not just in the region, which it is, the success of Iran in this period, but in Russia, and I'm told in China too. The Chinese have been quite, they didn't expect it, Iran, they thought Iran would manage, but they've been quite surprised at the success that Iran has had at its planning, its thinking, and the, if you like, asymmetric war that they've been planning for two decades. So it's having.
So this is another exciting, insightful Northern Sun Radio News with Don Olson and Dave Gunick. And next we're going to have Global Beat with Doug Kane.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Just after noon on March 3rd, 1991, a resident of Grand Rapids noticed the smell of oil in the air. This resident called the fire department, who immediately contacted Lakehead Pipeline Company. Lakehead operated an oil pipeline that passed through Grand Rapids. Lakehead quickly confirmed that this pipeline, Line 3, had ruptured. Crude oil was rapidly spilling into the Prairie River. The Prairie River is a tributary of the Mississippi, so authorities knew they needed to act fast to clean up the oil before it spread further south. Luckily, the river was still frozen, and the cold temperature made the oil more viscous, which prevented it from spreading too quickly. In the end, 1.7 million gallons of petroleum leaked from Line 3. It remains the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history. Lakehead's parent company rebranded to Enbridge Incorporated. And in 2021, Enbridge built a new Line 3 through northern Minnesota.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Okay. I think I've got a couple of